Support comes from Mosby Building Arts, replacing garage doors for improved curb appeal and energy efficiency. Details at callmosby.com.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio.
I'm Jason Rosenbaum.
As an older millennial, I've had the pleasure, if you want to use that descriptor, of witnessing monumental technological changes. And even though it may not provide the warm and fuzzy nostalgia of Super Nintendo or AOL Instant Messenger, I can grudgingly admit artificial intelligence could be one of the biggest advancements we've ever seen. I concede it took me a while to accept that AI could be useful. I derided AI systems like ChatGPT or Grok as gimmicky fads producing schlocky images and robotic prose. And it drove me nuts that AI programs continually got facts wrong, like when it claimed that former Missouri Governor Mel Carnahan was from Jefferson County. He was actually from Shannon County. I maintain that asking AI systems to write news articles or to produce images for publication is profoundly unethical. But I do think the technology has benefits. Case in point, one of my favorite hobbies is writing creative fiction. And I've been struggling for years with a novel I started when I was 18 and recently turned to Google Gemini. It gave me thoughtful suggestions like how to better develop some of my characters and make my dialogue sound more natural. And none of that assistance included copying and pasting AI-generated paragraphs. My hope was to turn my third-rate draft into something maybe second-rate. It turns out my response to AI isn't unique. ChatGPT co-founder Sam Altman says using AI as a creative partner is pretty common. At least that's what he told St. Louis on the Air's Elaine Cha when she asked him about how John Burroughs students are thinking about artificial intelligence.
The first reactions to AI are always interesting. When we launched ChatGPT, the world had a sort of collective freak out for a little while. And then people got over it and said, well, you know, this is just part of life now. And why is it not faster? Why is it not better? Why is it not smarter? That's something I love about just the human spirit of wanting more and more.
But one of the benefits of being a slightly crotchety older millennial is having enough life experience to recognize patterns when new technology changes the way we live. We've seen this with how we communicate with friends and family, how we work, how we're entertained. It's why texting replaced phone calls, streaming replaced Blockbuster, and even why using paper maps to get around can feel like a relic from a bygone era. In the case of AI, one of the areas that caught the attention of federal lawmakers is whether these programs degrade intellectual property. Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, for instance, is pushing legislation that could allow people to sue companies or individuals who use their content to train AI models.
Your name, your image, your likeness, they're using it. And what my bill would say is, hey, you've got to get permission, big tech, or the individual American Missouri citizen can go to court and sue you. Maybe even better, they can create a class action and get a whole bunch of people together and sue. And what will happen, Jason, if this gets enacted is big tech will start asking permission. And if enough people say no, they'll start offering to compensate. And that is how it should be.
But Hawley's idea is not going to face an easy road. President Donald Trump is much more amenable to big tech's leaders. And no surprise, many of them don't like the idea of placing statutory guardrails around AI. And some tech barons have a downright hostile approach to intellectual property laws. St. Louis native Jack Dorsey, who helped start Twitter and Square, contends there shouldn't be any intellectual property laws. He says they stifle innovation. Interestingly, Altman, who has praised Trump for how his administration has handled AI-related policy, said during his St. Louis on the Air interview that he doesn't see regulating artificial intelligence as negatively as other bigwigs in the tech world.
You know, when I get on an airplane, I don't sit there and like check all the engineering myself. I trust that there was a government agency that ran a process that means I can get on an airplane and have a very, very high degree of confidence that I'll get to where I'm going safely. And you know, it's popular to say, oh, regulation's terrible and slows things down. And it does slow things down in some cases, and it is annoying. And I'm sure there's more downsides than we even realize. But it is nice that when you get on that airplane, you trust that it's going to be safe.
Joining us to talk more about the debate about whether AI regulation is stifling our vital is Oliver Roberts. Roberts is the co-director of the WashU Law AI Collaborative and an adjunct professor of law teaching courses at the intersection of artificial intelligence, policy, and law. Oliver, welcome to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air.
Happy to be here, Jason. Thanks for having me.
Now, before we dive into the confluence between AI and governmental regulation, we should probably define what we're talking about here. When we talk about artificial intelligence programs like ChatGPT, Google Gemini, Grok, what are these things? What do they do?
Yeah, these are computer systems that are able to complete tasks that would otherwise take human capabilities, human problem solving. And to listeners, that probably sounds like a very amorphous definition. And that's one of the big problems in AI regulation. It is defined differently. You could Google definition of AI, you'll probably get 10 different definitions. And looking state to state, even how it's being defined, it's different.
I ask because this type of technology, to some, has been around for a while. Friend of the show, and full disclosure, my sister-in-law, Jackie Todd, writes, most of the AI I've worked with in entertainment has been rebranded machine learning, and that was a rebrand in and of itself. I like Grammarly, but some of its suggestions aren't grammatically correct either, and that was glorified Clippy to begin with. Clippy, of course, is the classic computer avatar that shows up in Microsoft Word asking to solve your word processing problems. Is my dear sister-in-law right? Is AI of today just an advancement of prior technology?
AI has been around for a long time, dating back to the 1950s, 60s. You even had the first AI chatbots that you could chat with back in the 1960s. It was a very rudimentary Q&A. You type something, you get an automated reply. But yes, AI has been around for decades. What has really changed in the past couple of years is the proliferation of generative AI. That's an AI system that could generate new content, new images, new text, new videos, and now it's just publicly available. So that's the big difference, the proliferation and the fact that it's providing economic value and it's free to a wide range of users worldwide.
We want to hear from you. Have you used AI in your daily life? And do you have concerns or optimism about how it could affect our future? Give us a call at 314-382-8255. That's 382-TALK. I'd like to get your take on Senator Josh Hawley's legislation that would allow people to sue companies or individuals that use their content to train AI models. Listener Kathy Johnson seems to like the idea, as she wrote on Instagram. Absolutely need tight guardrails and slow release into business, education, and personal areas. No personal information used without legal permission. What do you think of Hawley's proposal?
Yeah, so this bill was introduced back on July 21st. It's officially called the AI Accountability and Personal Data Protection Act. What it really focuses on protecting individual personal identifiable information, people's names, email addresses, biometric data, login information. So it really hones in on that. It doesn't necessarily touch on the broader copyright debates that are making their way through the court. So I do think this is a very focused and potentially beneficial for protecting people's individual rights. And it creates a federal cause of action, so an individual person can go into court and vindicate their rights if a tech company takes someone's data without the proper permissions. On the other side of it, the argument is that if tech companies have to go and get express permission from every single individual person and therefore data point, then it's going to slow down the growth of artificial intelligence and potentially stunt the US's AI development vis-a-vis other countries that we are geopolitically adverse to, such as China.
There, you mentioned kind of the debate about, I think, copyright and AI, because that was the subject of a Senate committee hearing in July. In fact, it featured an appearance from David Baldacci, who has written several dozen books, including Absolute Power. And he made this point about intellectual property during his opening remarks. Basically, the gist of his message was that AI companies would guard against anybody taking their copyrighted
intellectual property and using it for profit, why would you use a different standard for authors or people who use music or things like that?
Yeah, so this is an ongoing debate, and it's currently making its way through the courts. We now have over 48 copyright lawsuits, and they all have different iterations. You have some of these cases involving Getty Images suing AI companies for using their copyrighted images. You have individual authors, Mike Huckabee, former Arkansas governor, Sarah Silverman, a comedian. These people suing because their books have been used for AI training. So all these cases do have their own nuances. And what really complicates it is the affirmative defense that's being used by these AI companies is fair use. And the application of those fair use factors, which creates an exception to copyright law, those in themselves are often more amorphous and they're not always applied consistently and they could be fact specific. So this is kind of a gray area of the law that the courts are currently making their way through. So it could differ based on a case by case analysis.
Well, I think the specific question of intellectual property is interesting, and you're correct. I think the courts are ultimately going to decide the outcome on this. I think it hits a broader fear that AI will eliminate the need for authors, writers, journalists, any other profession that usually uses writing as kind of the core aspect of their job. Do you think these fears are warranted, given that other technological advancements have caused some jobs to become obsolete?
Yeah, I think those concerns are certainly valid. There are programs right now, you could go create entire songs from scratch from just a prompt. You have the melody of the lyrics of someone who's singing who never even existed. So this is a very real fear. And the irony when you compare the use of AI by artists and those by journalists, there's kind of this irony intrinsic to it. Because one of the big concerns when AI is, say, writing a news article or being used in law is hallucinations. Obviously, we don't want false information going into news reporting or legal briefs in the court system. And those fake citations and fake information are a product of hallucinations, which are intrinsic to large language models because they're predictive in nature. So that's problematic in that context, whereas hallucinations are actually beneficial when you're talking about creativity and artists. What hallucinations are, they're creating new information that may not be accurate, but may be more creative and outside the bounds of existing data sets. So that's what the catch-22 is there, where it actually is beneficial for creativity, whereas it might be more problematic in other contexts.
To stick on the point about AI and law, Missouri Attorney General-to-be Catherine Hanaway must have known that we were doing a segment on AI because she mentioned some ways to use the technology right after Governor Mike Kehoe announced her appointment.
Comparing deposition transcripts, you can automate that, expert witness testimony, summarizing depositions. You got to do some quality control checking, but these are tasks that would take assistant AGs a lot of time. And you can just automate a lot of that and really achieve some savings. And hopefully that'll allow us to do more cases and free up assistant AGs to kind of do the higher order level of thinking and take some of those rote things out. Even research can now be an AI plain language model. You know, the big research institutions like Westlaw all have quality ones that protect any personal information so that it doesn't get out into sort of those large language models.
That was Missouri Attorney General Designee Catherine Hanaway talking about the potential ways to use AI in the legal profession. Oliver, you talked about some of the downsides in your last response, but as an attorney, what do you think of Attorney General-to-be Hanaway's, I think, optimism about how AI could help in the legal profession?
Oh, certainly. Yeah, I think Attorney General Hanaway is spot on. And my prior response is just talking about some of the concerns of lawyers, where the hesitancy is with respect to possibly there being hallucinations with case research. But there are many, many benefits out there. Attorney General Hanaway hit on summarizing depositions. That's one of the big use cases right now in the legal field. Taking a huge document, being able to make a concise summary in just a couple seconds. Other areas are document review. You have these cases where you could have tens of thousands of documents where you'd otherwise have to sit and manually review them. But now you could review a subset of them, and then machine learning models and algorithms are able to then extrapolate over the entire document set and tag documents that are responsive, that have key terms. So it's fundamentally changing the practice of law right now. And the most reliable use cases are summarizing documents, reviewing them, and also in the contract review analysis as well.
We need to take a quick break, but when we return, we'll continue this discussion about the policy ramifications of regulating AI. This is the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. Welcome back to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air. I'm Jason Rosenbaum. We now return to our conversation with Oliver Roberts of the WashU Law AI Collaborative about how policymakers should approach artificial intelligence. And we're going to bring a new voice into the conversation, St. Louis Public Radio's environmental reporter, Kate Grumke. Kate is not only reporting on the environmental impact of artificial intelligence expansion, but as we'll explain, she's also used AI for a story that will be published on Monday. Kate, welcome to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air.
Thanks for having me.
Kate, one of the biggest criticisms I see online is that AI is wasting electricity and water. Can you talk about why AI would need so much of both of those things?
Yeah, so AI has these data centers that are basically buildings that house the computing power behind the system. And there are data centers all over the place. Here at St. Louis Public Radio, we have what I might consider a data center in our server room. So these have existed for a long time, but the scale of them that involves the AI systems is just gigantic. So to put this in perspective, last year, Ameren's largest customer had a peak electricity load of 32 megawatts. In Kansas City, there's a Google data center that's being built that is going to be around 400 megawatts. So these are just humongous increases in the amount of electricity that might be needed. And then on top of that, these systems get pretty hot. And so they also use water to cool them. And so that's another way that people are worried this might affect the environment.
We've seen some of this public backlash in an unusual place, St. Charles County, usually a place that is seen by many people as a conservative bastion and is not like, I guess environmental issues may not be top of mind in the stereotypical fashion. But there is huge opposition to a data center there, so much so that the company involved pulled the permit and is actually thinking about, and now St. Charles is actually thinking about banning these for a year. What happened here and why were people so upset?
Yeah, so there's a data center that is being proposed to be built in St. Charles near Highway 370. And there's a lot that I don't know about this project. So we don't know what the peak load of electricity is going to be for it. We don't know who it's for. We know who's building it, but we don't actually know who the end user is. And that's because this is all pretty secretive and there are a lot of NDAs that have been signed. And so the community that lives near where this site is proposed to be was very upset and has been showing up to public meetings to protest the data center. And so they did pull a application for a permit. And so now it's looking like they might come back with a revised proposal, but the city council in St. Charles is going to vote on a 1-year moratorium on new applications for data centers.
Oliver, what do you make of people expressing alarm about what these data centers, how they impact the environment? Because that seems to be a real widespread criticism of AI pretty much everywhere.
Yeah. So definitely a complicated issue. And one of the biggest issues with respect to evaluating the environmental effect of AI is just a lack of disclosures from the companies themselves. We really don't have much data into what the server sizes are, what the cooling methods are, what are the optimization techniques that these AI companies are using. So when you talk about the environmental impact, it goes beyond even just data centers and the water used and the electricity to run them, but also how these servers are being run, when they're being run. Google just a couple of days ago came out with their own methodology, doing their own evaluation of their own use of AI. And they looked at their energy use in data centers, how much water they use, the carbon footprint of running their models, and they claim to say that they've dropped now their carbon footprint by 33 times, and 44 times over the past year, they've dropped their median per prompt energy use. So these AI companies say they're optimizing their techniques and being better for the environment, but given the fact we don't have great methodologies, we don't have a lot of data from these companies, it's really tough to assess.
Let's go to Tom from Maplewood, who has an example of AI use and was not as enthusiastic maybe as my novel editing processes. Tom, welcome to the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air.
Thanks. I belong to a nonprofit that has chapters all over the country, and each one of them is an independent, different corporation, and people keep trying to use different AI models to generate the minutes for membership meetings. And so they'll get a transcript of the meeting, and then they'll feed it into the AI and tell it to make standard business meeting minutes. And the errors are interesting and sometimes funny. The name of the companies will be all mixed up with different chapters around the country. Sometimes if it's not sure who's speaking, it'll make up roles that they might have in Kansas, but we don't have in Missouri. And I think the main take home is something a lot of people are learning right now is that you have to proofread and edit anything that these AI tools spit out. You can't just take it and pretend that you actually did your own minutes in this case. But it's really kind of a catastrophe if it does give you a starting point for your minutes, but there are a lot of errors and a lot of hallucinations in that context.
Tom, thank you so much for your comment. Oliver, I'll go to you. While I think that Google Gemini has done a really good job in my experience, not only with my fiction hobby, but also reading documents for my job, I have seen instances where it gets information completely wrong. Like, for instance, when I put my novel through ChatGPT, since my main character's name is Scott, it thought it was Scott Pilgrim versus the World fan fiction, which it was definitely not. So can you kind of talk about why sometimes AI gets basic facts wrong when you ask it a question or ask it to do something?
Yeah, so it's an intrinsic feature of large language models right now. Large language models are trained on huge data sets, billions of data points, and what they're essentially trained to do is predict the next most likely word. So for example, let's say a bunch of articles from the New York Post, New York Times, Wikipedia, Reddit, they'll constantly say the capital of the United States is Washington, D.C., and that'll be in all these articles, all these books throughout human history. So it'll be very clear to a large language model, because it's seen all these data points, that obviously knows the capital of the United States is Washington, D.C. So that's what it's doing, predicting the next most likely word. Where a lot of hallucinations will happen is when there's a lack of training data. And this happens in the legal context very often, because a lot of state cases and district court cases at the federal level are not in this training data, because they don't make their way on the internet, so they're not in the data pool that large language models were trained on. So when there's a lack of predictable data, then that's when the LLM is just going to fill in the next most likely word, which is a lower probability of being coherent and accurate, and that's when you get false information. That is one of the theories of hallucinations. These still are considered black boxes. Even Claude, that is Anthropic, the makers of Claude, they issued an internal study on their own large language model a couple months ago, and they start off the study by saying, we don't fully understand how large language models work. And that's coming from the people who actually make these large language models.
So, Kate, I believe you've actually talked with a person who was recently on the show, State Representative Colin Wellenkamp, a Republican from St. Charles County, about the prospect of regulating artificial intelligence on a state level. What have you heard from him?
Yeah, so I ran into him at the open house in St. Charles for this data center, and I asked him what he thought about it, and he said, I don't have enough information to have an opinion yet. So he said there are good data centers and bad data centers, and he doesn't know what type of data center that one is because there's so much secrecy around the project. But he said that this is something that the legislature is definitely going to be talking about in the next session. He's part of the Missouri Future Caucus, which is tasked with coming up with policy recommendations for AI, and so he said they're going to be taking a look at this.
There was a provision in the One Big Beautiful Bill that would have barred states, I guess, in general from regulating AI. I don't know if it would have included regulations on whether these data centers get built, since I guess that's more of a local governmental responsibility. But Oliver, that idea didn't make it into the final version of the bill. I think you've written about this topic. What do you kind of think about the idea of not letting state governments regulate this technology?
Yeah, so that federal preemption debate kind of came out of nowhere to a lay observer. But this really built up over the past couple months, dating back to December. So in December, DeepSeek was released their more advanced model, and DeepSeek is China's leading large language model.
I believe it has like a whale as a mascot or something like that, or I might be mixing it up with something else, but continue.
Exactly. Yes, it's the whale. So the whale came onto the scene in December of this past year, and then they launched a new advanced model in January. And the relevance of this is the fact that the U.S. for a long time thought we were the sole leader in AI, but China quickly came onto the scene. They claimed they were able to train this model for a fraction of the cost that we've been investing in Microsoft and OpenAI and Google. But now China was up there with us in having the best large language models. So the AI debate then became a matter of national security, became a geopolitical issue, and that's when these AI companies started pushing for federal preemption. Because in all these different states right now, there's over 1,000 pending AI regulations, and these companies are going to have to navigate potentially 50 different frameworks of regulation. And these AI companies say that's going to kill our ability to expand and grow and compete with China. So they were able to lobby and get in this provision that would put a 10-year moratorium on state AI laws. Basically, what that means is in that one big, beautiful bill that was passed by Congress and made it to the Senate, no state could regulate AI for 10 years.
Even on environmental issues. Yeah, continue. But I want to chime in and ask you, did it include environmental regulations or energy regulations?
It was very broad, and it covered said all AI laws, and the only exceptions were state AI laws that would expedite permitting. So that does have touch on local environmental, but only local laws and state laws could stay in place if they help expedite AI development, such as permitting processes for data centers.
So I mentioned that because, Kate, that is actually something you're going to be working on, or you are working on, about how Ameren is preparing for data centers and how they're going to the Public Service Commission, which is the entity that regulates utilities. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you're reporting on that in that space?
Yeah, so people might remember there was a huge utility bill that was passed in the last legislative session known as SB4. And in that bill, it said that utilities needed to set up a tariff, which is basically terms of service, for big data centers, big users of electricity. And so both Evergy in Kansas City and Ameren in our area are currently going before Missouri's Public Service Commission to try to develop these policies. And this is kind of the forefront of how we're going to regulate AI right now. So there's all kinds of terms for basically trying to protect customers, just regular customers, from having to foot the bill for this, but then also trying to attract these companies to come to our area. Ameren wants to sell them electricity. And so there are things like minimum terms of service that if they come, they have to stay for a certain number of years. They have to buy a certain amount of electricity if they say they're going to. And it's really because they use so much energy that they need to build to serve them.
And in kind of a twist, so to speak, you've actually used AI to help report this story and to provide information to the public, and not in a way that you would stereotypically expect. This article is not written with AI generated by a prompt. Tell us a little bit how you're using this technology in the journalism world.
Yeah, so it sounds really similar to what we were talking about with legal documents. So these dockets that come before the Public Service Commission are just pages and pages of legal documents, basically. And so I used a tool called Google Pinpoint, which is run on AI, that helps kind of organize documents. And what I think of it as is like a Google search on steroids, just for what you're looking at, just for these documents. And in some ways, it was really useful. I could ask it something like, which of these documents has Ameren's best example of how it wants to create new renewable energy programs. And so it could point me to, okay, here's a link, you're going to go right here. But then when I asked it, what are the total number of pages in these documents? It just made up a number. It was not correct at all. So it's definitely something that it's pointing you in the right direction, but you still have to do the reading.
And Oliver, the last 30 to 45 seconds, if you can summarize, in a pre-interview, you mentioned the possibility of maybe AI replacing judges one day. Can you talk a little bit about that as the final point for this discussion?
Yeah, definitely. Just briefly, I see a world where we have alternative dispute resolution. Basically, two parties contract with each other to say, hey, let's upload our arguments onto this platform and we'll let AI decide. So basically take you outside the court system traditionally. And it's already a common thing with mediation, arbitration. So I think that would be the future between businesses or private citizens.
And do you think that's a good thing, or do you think that's uncanny valley territory that may actually repel people?
This would be for people that consent to it. So I do think it's beneficial if people just want to get their dispute settled immediately, not have to pay for an arbitrator or go through the court system. So I do think it'll deliver benefits and people would assume their own risks in going through that process.
Oliver Roberts is the co-director of the WashU Law AI Collaborative and an adjunct professor of law teaching courses at the intersection of artificial intelligence, policy, and law. Oliver, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Kate Grumke is St. Louis Public Radio's senior environmental and data reporter. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back on the Politically Speaking Hour on St. Louis on the Air.
Today's episode was produced by Jason Rosenbaum.
Our audio engineer is Aaron Doerr. This podcast was mixed and edited by Aaron.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thanks.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.